arrested and prosecuted for apology for terrorism for as little as carrying a Palestinian flag. Without the ability to openly criticize the policies of Israel, many believe it's difficult to imagine that Paris will reduce its unconditional support for Tel Aviv, no matter how many atrocities and war crimes they commit against Palestinians. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
South Korea's progressives extended their majority in the National Assembly in an election largely seen as a repudiation of conservative President Yoon Suk-yeol and his People Power Party. Democratic Party leader Lee Jae-myung promised to work for the greater good.
The ruling and opposition parties must work together to solve livelihood problems. We will spearhead the efforts to overcome the livelihood crisis. I once again express deep gratitude to the South Korean people.
Many South Koreans feel President Yoon has been overstepping his powers with a series of missteps and controversial measures, including the failure to resolve an ongoing doctor's strike.
There were too many cases where this government pushed through policies that made no sense, as if it were a dictatorship.
While the vote revolved around Yoon and the economy, with problems such as a lack of affordable housing and increasing polarization, Yoon's foreign policy latitude will also be curtailed.
This is really bad news for President Yoon. He's going to have an extremely hard time getting anything through the National Assembly. And what's more, it may jeopardize some of his great relations that he's formed with the U.S. and Japan during his presidency.
A new progressive party launched by Cho Guk, a former justice minister, won 12 seats in the assembly, further tipping the scales against President Yoon and his People Power Party.
The two-thirds majority enjoyed by progressives in the assembly will enable them to fast-track legislation and push their liberal agenda. Meanwhile, President Yoon's pro-business reforms stand little chance of becoming law, with Yoon something of a lame duck for the final 3 years of his five-year term. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Italy's Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani has released a new statement following Sunday's drone attack on Russian-held Zaporizhzhia power plant in eastern Ukraine. Tajani said the risk of creating a new Chernobyl must be averted and that a free zone around the nuclear plant must be immediately declared. He also advised against fighting in the vicinity of the nuclear plant. A few days ago, during a celebration for the 75th NATO anniversary, Tajani hinted at the possibility of resuming ties with Russia in the future.
We are not at war with Russia. We criticize Moscow's policies, but we are not at war with the Russian people, and we definitely intend to resume relations with the Russian people.
It is the first time Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, the largest in Europe, has been targeted in military action since November 2022. On Tuesday, Russia blamed Ukraine for launching drone attacks on the plant for a third day, but Ukraine denied an involvement.
The Italian Foreign Ministry's position on the nuclear plant attack is very interesting. Rome, for the first time since the start of the conflict in Ukraine, is not just taking the side of Kiev, but it is pragmatically looking at the interests of the whole of Europe, without focusing on who is to blame for the attack.
Also on Tuesday, the European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell reiterated a warning that the UN's atomic watchdog IAEA issued earlier this week. Borrell said the reckless drone attack in Zaporizhzhia increases the risk of a dangerous nuclear accident.
Italy has often reaffirmed its unwavering support for Ukraine, despite Russia's warning against such moves. The Italian government has so far approved 6 military support packages to Kiev, inclusive of both lethal and non-lethal equipment and specialized military training activities. Max Civili, Rome.
As India prepares to hold the world's largest electoral exercise from April 19, The main opposition National Congress Party has said the country will lose its secular democratic credentials if the ruling BJP attains power another term, accusing Prime Minister Modi's party of dictatorship. In its election manifesto, the party has promised to boost social spending, saying Modi's ruling party has favored the interests of only the rich. The opposition party promised to uplift the marginalized if it comes to power. Pre-election polls, however, predict Modi sweeping back for a third term. Election results will be declared on June 4th.
Most Indians have realized that only Congress Party can do good for poor and minorities, which is what democracy means. The country is divided today due to politics of division just for votes.
India's main opposition party, which ruled the country for decades, has been struggling to compete with Modi's ruling BJP, which mainly counts on country's largest Hindu majority population for its vote share. The Congress Party, while releasing its election manifesto, has promised more help for the marginalized, including assured jobs for young, improving farmers' income, and better health insurance payouts. The Congress Party accused Modi's BJP of threatening the constitution.
Our party has been crippled using tax agencies. Is it level playing ground? This is not only Congress Party. They will also do same with media houses. So we need to save democracy and constitution. We have to unite against autocratic policies of the BJP government.
Accusing Modi's BJP of crippling his party by freezing its bank account in tax dispute, the opposition party manifesto has vowed to undo BJP policies if the party comes to power, promising that all anti-people laws passed by the ruling BJP without proper democratic process will thoroughly be reviewed and changed, including a much-debated electoral bond controversy. The party is sure to address issues related to minorities, communal conflicts, mob lynching and counter-killings, bulldozer politics and suppression of human rights and shrinking dissent. The Congress Party, the main challenger to the BJP, hopes to mount a challenge to Modi's BJP by joining hands with regional parties. The ruling party has, however, downplayed Congress Party's manifesto as a bundle of lies, saying they ruled for 50 years, which is now a divided house of leaders working for personal interests.
In 2014, Modi's ruling BJP gained popularity among India's Hindu majority, promising revolutionary changes in the country, including a crackdown on corruption and economic prosperity. Critics, however, argue another term for the ruling BJP would undermine India's status as a secular democracy, as the ruling party's broader agenda is to transform India into a Hindu supremacist nation. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Highly politicized French polling agencies have rarely dared to make surveys on Palestine, but after 6 months of attempted genocide, a new poll shows public opinion dramatically shifting against Israel. Since October, support for Israel's plan to eliminate Hamas has dropped from 65 to 56%, while condemnation for Israel's war aim has jumped from 35 to 44%. Following the mainstreaming of Islamophobia, France had become an ardently pro-Zionist country. But the polls show that a nation evenly split on support for Palestine isn't far away.
Here in France, we have many stars and actors who are Arabs and Muslims, but who don't say a word about Palestine and who don't support the Palestinian cause openly. It's a shame because they could have a big impact on the French public. Instead, they shut themselves up.
Israel est illégitime.
Israel is illegitimate and has no right to exist. Palestine is unjustly occupied, and I don't see how anyone can fail to see that. I'm waiting for Iran and Hezbollah to do their work, and for Israel to get out.
As Palestinians return to the city of Khan Yunis, Gaza's second largest city, the results of 6 months of war are catastrophic. Israel has killed over 33,000 people and wounded 80,000 others in Gaza, the West Bank, and Lebanon. Famine is affecting half of Gaza's 2.2 million people, while some two-thirds of the nation's buildings have been reduced to rubble.
Vraiment, il faut que cette guerre-là, elle cesse.
This war really has to stop.
People are forgetting that the Palestinians are humans, just like everyone else. There are just horrible things going on for women and children. And there has to be peace immediately.
After 6 months, the United Nations Human Rights Council finally took a position on the horrific invasion. They called for a halt in all arms sales to Israel and for Israel to be held accountable for possible war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Many attribute the Western public's shift against Israel not to the mainstream media or brave politicians, but to the gruesome and heartbreaking images being relayed on social and alternative media. Images of the human costs of the West's support for Tel Aviv have long been censored. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Afghanistan is now battling an invisible foe that threatens its future generations. The World Food Program has sounded the alarm on the rising tide of malnutrition cases, a crisis worsened by the country's ongoing economic challenges and reduced international aid. Marking the World Health Day, the Taliban's Minister of Public Health expresses concern over the malnutrition crisis, calling for international support.
It is clear that Afghanistan is one of the poor countries in the world. There is no doubt that children and mothers are grappling with malnutrition. We need the support of the world in combating the disaster. I call on the UNICEF, WHO and WFP to continue their assistance to our people with poor health conditions, especially those suffering from malnutrition.
The impact of international sanctions and the U.S. policies cannot be overlooked in understanding the gravity of the situation. That is a warning by pediatricians here in Afghanistan. Years of conflict have severely damaged the country's infrastructure, making it a challenge to provide adequate healthcare and nutrition to vulnerable groups. Moreover, recent cuts in international assistance as well as the Western-led sanctions are worsening things.
There are also some foreign factors exacerbating the malnutrition crisis in Afghanistan. Afghan assets that belong to Afghans and are meant to support our economy are frozen. We are witnessing a decline in international health assistance, especially to our children. Some international bodies continue to collaborate, but these are not sufficient. Some organizations that used to support families have ended their missions in Afghanistan.
Lots of people like me are coming to this hospital because their children are malnourished. I think everything boils down to a single problem, economic shortcoming. If our family had enough to eat, our children wouldn't become undernourished. People don't have money and they're not receiving aid anymore.
Experts emphasize that the need for immediate aid cannot be overstated. Afghan families are in desperate need of assistance to combat this malnutrition crisis. The international community must come together to provide the necessary resources and support to save lives and alleviate the suffering of the Afghan people. The economic crisis in Afghanistan is taking a toll on the health and well-being of the war-ravaged nation. Advocates warn that without a significant increase in support, the crisis will further deepen. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Thousands of Austrians marched under the slogan "Stop the genocide, stop the occupation" in the capital Vienna. The Palestine Committee and Palestine Solidarity Austria organized the demonstration. The march was held on Saturday, a week after house raids of Palestinian activists in the city of Linz. Police recently also interrogated protesters in other cities. International Quds Day was an aspiration for the organizers of Saturday's protest.
And all these commemoration days is to really say, wake up, we are really in the situation where people are getting killed every day and we have to stop it as soon as possible.
Organizers also criticized a four-day visit of the President of the Austrian Parliament, Wolfgang Sobotka, to Israel this week.
Well, obviously, when looking at the last 6 months, there's been some unconditional support. for Israel, obviously, and their action in the Gaza Strip, which is absolutely unacceptable.
Several speakers stressed Austrian solidarity with Palestinians in war-torn Gaza as the US-Israeli genocidal war continues unabated. They said the Austrian government does not speak for them.
It's the most obvious wrongdoing that I've ever seen in my life.
The protesters called for support for Lebanon and Yemen against US imperialist aggression. People from around the world joined the Vienna March.
I was born in Chile under a dictatorship and I have a lot of Palestinian friends. I am even wearing a t-shirt from a team called Palestina who was founded by Palestinian migrants several years ago. I couldn't be in peace with myself if I wasn't here demonstrating and saying and raising my voice, at least.
Representatives of Jewish organizations such as Not In Our Name stressed their continued solidarity with the Palestinian struggles. Organizers said all Austrians must continue to protest against the US-Israeli genocide and their government support for it, despite the repression.
We cannot call ourselves humans, regardless of our nationalities or political views or religions, and be indifferent about what's going on nowadays in Gaza.
Thousands marched in the Austrian capital Vienna in support of the people and the resistance in Gaza as the Israeli genocide war claims more civilian lives. Despite Austria's repression, the state and the police were unable to stop the Palestine solidarity movement. Saturday's demonstration has once again shown that the support for Gaza remains strong in Austria. Dieter Reinisch, Vienna.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Day 190 of the U.S.-Israeli war on the Gaza Strip, and the devastation has taken a turn for the worse. This is in reference to the city of Khan Yunis as an example. Near total destruction. Reason? Massive arms and bombs provided by countries like the U.S. and the U.K. who have said it cannot stop arms sales to the Israeli regime. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at the depth of the genocidal war in all of its aspects, the worldwide pro-Palestine solidarity protest, and why hopes were dashed again for Palestinians' quest for statehood, even though there are many countries eager to support Palestinian statehood. First, let me introduce our guests. Mick Knapp here joins us from the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign in Edinburgh. Also joining us is Peter Ford, former British ambassador to Syria, who joins us from Manchester. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Mick Knapp here, if I may start with you, and let's look at the UK arms sales and what the UK has said, that it's not going to suspend its arms exports to Israel. Now, what's interesting is what David Cameron has said, that he reviewed the most recent legal advice about the situation on the ground, but this left the UK's position on export licenses unchanged. Now, if there's legal advice that the situation on the ground was reviewed, doesn't that mean that they also reviewed the fact that over 33,000 Palestinians have been killed, which equals to a genocide, and then they made a decision to make that announcement?
The British government are just making excuses. The truth is that they want to continue to help Israel with its bombing because they share 100% the Israeli objective of crushing the Palestine resistance. The government are, however, under some pressure because of the legal situation. It would be against British law to supply arms to a country that was committing genocide. And therefore, the government are reluctant to reveal the legal advice that they are receiving, because a child can see that a genocide is going on, and therefore the British government are just trying to hide the truth.
Well, let's break this down a little bit further, McNapp here. Sorry about the mix-up there. In terms of this statement by David Cameron, he says that based on legal advice, the UK is acting within international law. Now, trying to wrap our head around that, when you have the ICJ, the UN, like the UN Special Rapporteur for the Palestinian Territories, Francesca Albanese, and a host of other organizations that I'm sure you're more familiar with, have said that what is taking place is a genocide, then how can the UK, I don't know if I should ask you how the UK could be acting within international law, or how could David Cameron have the courage to come out and say that?
I think the word is not courage, it's shamelessness. I mean, the British government, this is not the first time they've backed a genocidal regime. Margaret Thatcher famously appeared on television at a time when Britain and America were backing the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia against the Vietnamese installed government to say that there was a faction of the Khmer Rouge, the moderates, with whom Britain could work. So if you can work with the Khmer Rouge, you can work with Netanyahu to try to exterminate tens and tens of thousands of Palestinians. No, this is the infinitely elastic British government concept of international law, where international law extends to the obvious violation of international law. Look, the Genocide Convention is unlike any other. It absolutely enjoins and demands that all the affiliated governments, all the governments that endorse the convention, must take every available means within their power to stop a genocide starting or to bring it to an end as quickly as possible. But we see, for example, the main government, could I say, in Yemen, taking practical action in support of Palestine, in support of Gaza, trying to interdict Israeli supply lines to come to the aid of the people in Gaza under genocide. But Britain and America bomb them. So it's not just that they are turning a blind eye to international law. They're violating any conceivable concept of international law. Because once again, the ICJ has said there is a plausible case for genocide against Israel. That means it's likely or probable or very, very much on the cards. Once that's in the frame, then it's quite clear the British government and the Americans are utterly opposed to any vestige of international law. And you know, the main one of the Christian spokesmen in Jerusalem made the point recently. Whenever Britain and America ever raise their voices to talk about human rights, you don't need a detailed lawyer to respond. You just have to say Gaza. And that means that everything they say should not be taken, nothing they say should be taken seriously in that area from now on. So I think that the fact that Cameron is continuing to send the weapons really means they're paying a very high price in terms of isolation. In terms of big millions and millions of people around the world deciding never to believe another word the British government says. Now, we know about perfidious Albion. I don't want to cast any aspersions on your other guest, an ex-ambassador, but we know that Britain is a byword for dishonesty in the field of diplomacy. But now to say that this is despite hundreds of lawyers, including High Court judges, who've just written a letter recently saying that Britain is very likely in breach of international law. Cameron digs in, but nobody believes him. I don't even think he believes himself.
Well, taking a look at the U.S., the other major country, if not at the top of the list, Peter Ford, you know, it's really interesting how they come about and make their case when it comes to, first of all, There's not a genocide that's taking place. This is what the U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin has said. He has also said that and acknowledged that 25,000 women and children have been killed in this genocide. He didn't call it a genocide, of course. And then you have Israel also, probably around 100, or maybe even more at this point, of what's called these licenses, where it doesn't hit the threshold or it doesn't hit that maximum dollar amount that's required for an announcement. And it is said about 100 of those have been at this point executed, with arms being sent to Israel, which a lot of it has to is consisted of bombs. Do you think the U.S. is trying to deceive its arms deliveries to the Israeli regime by doing that, in terms of not getting to that dollar amount?
Well, the American and British governments pay lip service only to international law. They insist that other countries follow international law, but as far as they're concerned, it does not apply to themselves or to their puppet, Israel. This is the basic truth of the matter. And they employ scores of lawyers who provide them with legal excuses to continue flouting international law. And sadly, the world is a jungle. Nobody is going to force a country to apply international law, except the main villains themselves, the US and the UK, attempt sometimes to force other countries to respect international law. But there is nobody, certainly not the International Court of Justice, or the ICC, the International Criminal Court, which has the power to bring these two accomplices in crime to book. That is the sad fact. So the British take refuge behind the excuse that the assessment that they carried out of whether Israel was committing war crimes predated the judgment, the interim judgment, by the ICJ. And we will all have to wait until the next assessment, which may be some months down the track, before it becomes clear what the British position is. It's a farce.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
When you take a look at the way international conventions and laws have been broken, maybe it's quite unprecedented, Mick Napier, if you take a look at what has happened when it comes to this genocidal war. And in particular, one day, April 1st, actually, where Israel broke two international conventions three times in one day. It started out with the Al-Shifa genocide, where the revelations came out about hundreds of bodies being discovered. It was 400 and plus that were reported. And then it came that attack, a terrorist act that Iran called on its consular building in Syria. And then you had the aid workers that were also killed, all in one day. Isn't that a mockery of just any type of law that Israel is making, is breaking all norms when it comes to that?
Yes, and I share Peter Ford's analysis that this is a mockery. I mean, this has been a long time coming. Israel has never felt bound by any notion of international law whatsoever. It considers itself to be exceptional. I mean, one notable example reported of the Israeli cabinet is that when Israel invaded an Arab capital in 1982, Lebanon, in Beirut, when a UN delegation visited the city and began to talk about the need for Israel to withdraw, it's reported by members in the Israeli media that there was a touch of humor involved when Israel shelled the center of the city at precisely 2:42 and 3:38 in the afternoon, and killed a large number of people with their shells, of course, in order to underline contempt for the United Nations. This was widely understood in Israel. So Israel, for a very long time, has responded to appeals to follow international law by such murderous response and such contempt. Look, there's only one country so far which has been found guilty of terrorism by an international court. And it's no surprise that Nicaragua today is in the middle of a case against Germany for complicity in the genocide. Because Nicaragua took America to, I think it was the ICC, and was supported in a charge against America being guilty of terrorism by mining their harbors, by funding the Contras, by killing literacy workers, teachers, hospital workers, and so on. But a fat lot of good it did them. America simply ignored that finding. Israel again in 2004 was found guilty by the ICJ, and a ruling was given that they had to take down the separation wall, the so-called apartheid wall, which they were building across the whole apartheid. What happened? All the states that were affiliated to the court refused to take any sanctions against Israel, increased their arms sales, and that was why precisely a year to the day in 2005, the Palestinian civil society launched an appeal for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. They say we have been let down. We've gone to international courts, okay, but no appeal to morality to these governments has any effect. So we need to try something else. So America, Britain, Israel—they always completely disobey international law when it suits them.
Well, maybe that's one of the things that is the basis for the resistance groups in the region, Peter Ford. In particular, Islamic resistance of Iraq, for example, as an example, not to mention Yemen, who are, in a sense, taking matters in their own hands when international rule-based order, so to speak, has failed. And they just want this genocidal war to stop. But yet, since it hasn't, they're targeting the occupied Palestine in terms of the Israeli regime. What do you make of the fact that we're looking at this attack, a terrorist act that Iran has called it, on Iran's consular building in Syria. Do you see that, Peter Ford, as a sign where the Israeli regime has failed, has been defeated on the ground in the Gaza Strip, and therefore needs to widen the war and picked, I would say, the wrong, country to pick on, and that's Iran?
Well, the attack on the Iranian consulate was a blatant violation of international law, and specifically the Vienna Convention relating to embassies and consulates. I can tell you as a former diplomat that the Vienna Convention is holy writ is sacred for all diplomats all over the world, because at the end of the day, it's their only protection against violence. And the Israelis broke this convention. And then Britain and the United States not only failed to condemn it, but they prevented the Security Council from issuing a statement condemning the blatant attack. As a result, no diplomat anywhere in the world can feel safe anymore. And the two countries that are supposed to be the biggest supporters of the Vienna Convention and other international laws are, in fact, the biggest breakers of these laws. And as a diplomat, I can tell you it's absolutely shocking. But to anyone who knows how the administrations of the UK and the US work hand in glove with Israel, it's not surprising. Israel has been waging a war on Syria for at least 5 years. Hundreds, literally hundreds of bombings have taken place. the recent attack on the Iranian consulate was not the most serious in terms of victims. But Israel gets away with it because it is given protection by the United States and Britain.
Well, we are looking at another day where there were massive and large-scale protests in solidarity with Palestinians that took place in McNapier. But we're looking at this to have taken place more or less in the past 6 months, and not just over in London or other areas in the UK, but worldwide, really. I mean, like Jordan, consecutive days in a row they've been protesting. What type of impact do you think that has had, whether it's on the political scene or otherwise? The thing that comes to my mind is the boycott, of which these types of protests have really given momentum to the boycott movement, which you could probably tell us how that has panned out.
Well, it's a slow burn, but really the images of the last 6 months have burned so deeply into many, many millions of people's minds that it's impossible to go back to the status quo for many people. Today I was on a demonstration in Glasgow that shut down one branch of Barclays Bank, and then they went to a supermarket and briefly closed that down as well. There's an appetite now in the pro-Palestine solidarity movement to escalate. We saw a million people march through London for Palestine recently. Unprecedented numbers. We've never seen anything like that before. And because the genocide is continuing and people feel particularly impotent and unable to stop it, there is an appetite to escalate. And we saw activists close down the third Israeli arms factory in Britain by Elbit a few weeks ago, and activists are inspired by this and beginning to think that this kind of direct action and mass mobilization together is the only thing that can make a difference. Look, when the word genocide comes into the frame, all etiquette, all protocol is off. I remember during the Rwanda massacre, the Rwanda genocide, of course, the UN general in charge, a man called, I think it was called Romeo Dallaire, because America absolutely refused to use the word genocide because they knew what it entailed, he was absolutely distraught. And later, for a few years, he became an alcoholic, absolutely devastated. America was determined during that genocide not to allow the word genocide to be used, and it's exactly the same thing with Gaza today. We are facing the reality that the phrase that's trotted by off the lips of Western diplomats, the rules-based international order, millions, hundreds of millions of people now realize there is no rules-based international order. There is no international law, and the only way to protect life and to avoid the atrocious suffering is through resistance. Resistance of all kinds against the perpetual war machine that we now see at work in Gaza, forcing a situation of disease and starvation, unspeakable atrocities. And these unspeakable atrocities are an acid eating away at the status quo, and millions of people determined that they cannot continue with this status quo. So I think having been involved in BDS for a very long time, it doesn't go up gradually. It goes up through a particular massacre. It goes up by step. And I fully anticipate this step to be far and away the greatest step that the boycott and divestment movement is going to take.
All right. You know, when it comes to that, back to that attack on Iran's consular building, Peter Ford, if there is going to be any type of military engagement with Iran, which Iran has promised that there's going to be a counter attack, how do you think Israel's going to be able to handle that if we were looking at other groups, resistance groups in the region to also engage Israel militarily? Because we know with Hezbollah, they're engaged on that front. We know that the Islamic Resistance of Iraq, for example, is targeting Israel quite a bit. It's upped the number of attacks in the past 2 weeks especially. I mean, can Israel actually be stretched on so many fronts?
Well, Israel has started a process now which may go beyond what they expected by breaking a taboo, by crossing a red line with the bombing of a diplomatic office. They may have bitten off more than they can chew. Israel is not able, I believe, to sustain a war on two fronts for more than a few days. And if they, in the end, provoke Iran to the extent that a new front is opened up, Israel will suffer very badly. They will not be able to proceed with their plans in Gaza, for one thing. Already, without Iran lifting a finger, we see that the Israelis are panicking. They've already withdrawn a lot of their troops from Gaza. They have put the country on alert. Economic activity in Israel has come to a standstill. Israel is a small country with not a very large population. They are not able to sustain this level of activity, military activity, for very long. And this is before Iran has even lifted a finger. Israel is already paying a heavy price for what they did in Damascus.
Thank you, Mick Napier, Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Peter Ford, thank you so much, former British ambassador to Syria.
Welcome.
With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tagway and the team, it's goodbye.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Shaima al-Sawaf is one of hundreds of families across Gaza partly or entirely wiped out by the Zionist regime bombardment. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, the life of Shaima al-Sawaf was turned upside down in an instant. The 30-year-old, who has lived in Jordan since her marriage in 2013, lost 50 members of her family after an Israeli regime missile weighing hundreds of kilograms struck their home in Gaza. The al-Sawaf family is one of hundreds of families in the Gaza Strip that have been partially or wholly wiped out by the Zionist regime's bombardment of the enclave since October 7th. Last summer, Shaima visited her family in Gaza. She spent weeks with them as if she was saying goodbye without knowing it. Among those killed were her father, Mustafa, her mother, Maha, her brothers, Mahmoud, Montasser, Marwan and Ahmad, her nieces and nephews, Bara, Maha, Karam, Shahad and Omar, her sister-in-law, Zain. Omar was the youngest at only 18 months old, while a number of her uncles, cousins, and their wives also lost their lives. The bad news arrived quickly. Hours after the bombing, Shaima was able to call her cousin, who continued to cry bitterly down the phone. Shaima's husband took the phone and spoke to him, then fell silent, ended the call, and tears began to flow down his cheeks. I went crazy. I lost my nerve. I started screaming. Tell me who among them died, recalled Shaima. She said, he said desperately, all of them. I had a nervous breakdown and didn't feel anything around me after that. More than 31,000 Palestinians have been martyred in the ongoing Zionist regime's assault. while more than 71,000 have been injured, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. 40 days before the start of the Zionist regime's assault, Shaima left for her home in Amman. When she met her husband, a refugee from Jaffa, and left Gaza, she felt that she had left a piece of her heart behind. But she remained in daily contact with her family for hours, following their news and sharing their events from a distance. She said, "The war began with a constant anxiety inside me. I could barely sleep and I watched the news and the sights of the Israeli bombing, which didn't differentiate between man, woman, child, elderly, sick and wounded. If I hadn't left, if I had stayed and died with them." With the beginning of the Israeli regime airstrikes, Shaima's long calls to her family turned into short words just to make sure they were okay. The family left their home in the Sheikh Ajlin neighborhood when the bombing intensified and moved to a residential building in At-Tofa area where Shaima's uncles live and where her father also had an apartment. At dawn on November 18th, Shaima read the news that a residential building had been targeted in the same area. She was terrified and started crying while trying to contact her family, but no one answered. She said, "My anxiety and fear increased. My husband tried to calm me down, but I felt a disaster was approaching. Communications were cut off from Gaza and I knew nothing. I didn't sleep. I didn't eat. I did nothing but pray and cry." Due to the lack of facilities and the imposed siege, the civil defense crews were unable to work effectively at the site of the bombing. The whole family was struck under the rubble and were extracted dead, except for Zaid, aged 8, the son of Mahmoud, who was killed with his wife and the rest of their children. Shaima describes what happened as an unforgettable tragedy. Little by little, the news began to reach Shaima. The next day, she received word of the survival of her brothers, Montasser, Marwan, Mu'taz, and Muhammad, who were injured. Montasser, her journalist brother, who lost one of his eyes in the bombing, called and began to console her and reassure her about him and the rest of her siblings who had survived. She said, "I continue to cling to the hope that a number of my siblings had survived, despite my intense pain over the loss of my parents and my nephews. I spoke every day with Marwan and Montasser, and I didn't know that these were farewell calls to them as well." On December 1st, an Israeli regime plane bombed the Al-Daraj neighborhood in Gaza City, killing Montasser, Marwan, and a number of other relatives. Montasser remained bleeding for about half an hour without any ambulances being able to reach him. Rayyan 10, one of Shaima's three children, sits in his room in Amman and cries hard. Shaima said he loved his cousins very much and talked to them constantly. He had a special relationship with my father. I'm still in pain like the first day of the massacre. I talk to their pictures and imagine them next to me. The most painful thing for Shaima is that she couldn't look at them one last time before burying them because of the war and siege. She said, "Gaza is everything I love, and it has the smell of my family and their memories," adding she hoped to return one day. Shaima is left with only her two brothers, Mu'taz, and the injured Muhammad, who needs to travel for treatment but still can't. She talks to them daily and they try to heal their wounds together by remembering the family members amid constant fear due to the continued Israeli regime aggression. Before the war began, due to a glitch in her phone, Shaima lost her photos of her family and was unable to recover them. She said, "I got very angry and cried more. I want to look at them again, but I don't have all the pictures. Our first house was completely bombed and turned into rubble, and all my brother's phones were crushed by that." Today, Shaima lives a severely diminished life. Despite everything that has happened, she says that she's still waiting for one of them to contact her, even if the wait is forever.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.